Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Acting Perspective Podcast. I'm your host, Hugh Sivinick. Today with me is Dr. John Astin. John is the author of four books exploring the nature of human experience: Too Intimate for Words in 2005, This Is Always Enough, 2008, Searching for Rain in a Monsoon, 2012, and his latest book, This Extraordinary Moment, in 2018. He is also a singer, songwriter, and recording artist, having produced 7 CDs of original spiritual contemplative music. Along with his teaching, writing, and music, John holds a PhD in health psychology and is an internationally acclaimed scholar in the field of mind-body medicine, his research focusing on the applications of meditative contemplative practices in psychology and healthcare. He is presently an adjunct professor of clinical and counseling psychology at Santa Clara and Notre Dame de Namur universities. So without further ado, please help welcome Dr. John Astin.
Yeah, it's of course all a bit mysterious how we end up being drawn to the things that we're drawn to and become interested in the things we get interested in, which certainly in my case, kind of around 19 years old, a set of different things, a close friend who was starting to explore sort of unusual experiences he was having that was kind of coming out of the blue, conversations I was having with him, conversations with another friend, and then just this curiosity that just sort of began arising for me around exploring, I guess you could say, kind of the inner world that felt like it came somewhat out of the blue for me. But the next thing I knew, I kind of was being given books about meditation and Eastern thought, and was all very new to me. And I was very curious. I kind of dove in head first, and there was a part of that. It was a period of maybe about a year of exploring some psychedelics as well as part of that journey, and found that the doors of perception, as Aldous Huxley called it in his book, you know, were starting to open up for me, and just it's sort of a new world being revealed, and I was just increasingly curious to explore that world.
Did you read that book before you?
I don't think I read it before. I did some experimenting with those substances. That period didn't last very long, as mentioned, maybe about a year. You could count on one hand the time that I tried psychedelics, but I think at the time it was part of the puzzle of my own exploration and unfolding and discovery.
What are we talking about here?
What are we talking about?
Yeah, I'm now, sorry? When are we talking about?
I was a sophomore in college. Yeah, so okay. Like 19 or 20 years old.
Okay. And, late 60s?
No, more like late 70s, yeah.
Late 70s, I mean.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. And dropped out of school at the time because I felt like I really wanted to learn about this whole area of investigation and inquiry. I didn't really feel school was offering me that opportunity to explore those things. So I just sort of educated myself for several years before I went back and ended up finishing my degree later on. But so I initially got involved in kind of a yoga, traditional yoga meditation path, the teachings of Yogananda, he had passed away in the 50s. He was one of the first yogis to come to the U.S. and sort of spread the gospel of yoga and meditation. And I was very taken by his teachings, almost became a monk in his order at the time. I was 21 or so. And I really believed very strongly that meditation was going to get me to the goal that I was aspiring to realize, which, you know, I put different ways, you know, God realization, self-realization, awakening, enlightenment, peace, oneness. These were things I was searching for, and again, I thought meditation was the way to do that, and so I practiced.
I was just curious as to why you were so interested. Now, what kind of made you fall into that and pursue it so heavily?
I honestly, I couldn't say.
Yeah.
It was like as I was infected with some virus or something. Suddenly I just found myself drawn to it. Yeah, it just sort of, for me, in my particular journey, I didn't really feel like suffering was a catalyst for my search. I had a, what felt like a quite happy childhood, and went off to college, excited to go to college and study political science at the time. And I mean, I didn't feel like I was struggling a lot in my life, and so that I don't think was the prompt for the seeking that arose in me. Yeah, it's interesting. I can't really say what was prompting it, other than there it was, and
Yeah, but
it was strong. It was strong in me, and I think, I was certainly reading things that were suggesting, wow, there's something else, there's something more than what you think is going on here. There's something grander, more sublime, more sacred, more profound. So you read stories from different spiritual traditions suggesting this, and I was certainly intrigued by that idea. And so I practiced this particular style of meditation for several years. I basically grew to feel that that particular path that I was on, that kind of yoga-inspired meditation path, was, for me, something felt off about it. It felt like it was just kind of some rigidity in that teaching and organization that was sort of, sharing the teaching. And it also felt like there was an element of kind of denying our human side somewhat. It was really emphasizing the transcendence of the human realm, and I was both attracted to that, but also something felt like, well, wait a minute, what about the human realm somehow? And I found myself gravitating. I also had a very strong interest in teaching meditation, sharing it with others, because I was finding myself, benefiting from it, even though I also struggled with meditation at the same time, which I can maybe talk about at some point in our conversation. But so I knew I wanted to teach this, and I also got interested in studying meditation academically because I had returned to school, and I wanted to try to integrate my interest in meditation and all of that with academia somehow, and became aware that research had been ongoing for maybe a decade or so at that point. And this is the early 80s now, when I went to return to school, and I kind of jumped into that curiosity of studying meditation. And along with that, I realized, because the teachings I'd been studying were sort of secret, you couldn't share them with other people unless you were part of the organization, I felt like I wanted to learn a style of meditation that I could teach and research. And so I gravitated towards more of a Buddhist kind of Vipassana meditation approach, inspired by the work of Jon Kabat-Zinn, who was starting to do research on mindfulness meditation at the time. But I got involved in this more sort of Buddhist-inspired form of meditation that was, again, being researched. I started doing research on it myself as a graduate student, and continued on doing that for several years. And I mentioned that I'd struggled with meditation, and I certainly did. I sort of did it because I felt like, and read, that this was important and was going to kind of get you to where you wanted to get in terms of my spiritual seeking. And I did struggle with it. I didn't feel like I was very effective, a very good meditator. Struggled with my restless mind, like many people do. And sometimes it just felt like a chore, but I did it diligently. But yeah, but I did struggle with it. And then I went on a retreat with a kind of an unusual teacher, who had been influenced by Advaita Vedanta, kind of a part of the, kind of Indian spiritual tradition. And he was leading a retreat, and while on that retreat, I would say my life really, really changed, because I discovered on that retreat that what I'd been searching for now, like I said, been a couple of decades at that point, because this was 2000 and 2001, I guess, was when I did that retreat. And I just came to realize through, I don't really know how it happened exactly, but I was sitting during one of the meditation sessions and I felt this very strong presence, is what I would describe it. It felt somehow, the presence felt divine, it felt holy somehow, it felt very profound and powerful. And I was, of course, intrigued by the sense of this presence. Felt very, yeah, it felt very, very powerful, very sacred, and it was very strongly present. And I was just marveling at this sense of this presence. And I felt the presence kind of growing closer to me as I was sitting in meditation. And then all of a sudden, just like in a snap of a fingers, I realized why it felt so close, this presence, was because the presence was what I was. That's how close it was. And that there was nothing but this presence, basically. The presence of what is, the presence of reality, the presence of God, the presence of divinity, the presence that is all things. And of course, it's what I was, what is what everything was. And
Right.
that was a rather extraordinary, shocking sort of discovery to make, because the whole search that I'd been on, even though I had read a lot about, what you're realizing is that, you are this singularity, this oneness, this divinity that you're searching for. Of course, even the yoga tradition itself, yoga means union, the union of the soul and the Atman and Brahman, the soul and God. That's the yoga path. So I was aware of this kind of concept of oneness, and I was searching very ardently to discover it in my own experience. But to kind of see in that moment on that retreat that I was the very thing I'd been looking for, that it was here, that it was always here, was never absent, was just, like I said, just a shocking thing to discover, because I'd, of course, been imagining that it was absent, which is why I was looking so hard for it,
Right.
searching for so hard to discover it, right?
You used a great metaphor in in a previous podcast where you said it's like you're journeying home, like you're going home, and when will we be home? When you
Yeah.
realize, no, you are home.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, that and that was that sense of a homecoming, a sense of returning. You think of the metaphor of home, like being comfortable at home and at peace at home and a place where you can let go and relax and feel at ease. I feel at home, right? I feel like I can just be. And of course, yeah, that was exactly, it was exactly it, that was sense of a homecoming. And but strangely, a home that I'd never actually left, but just imagined that I had somehow strayed from the home and then had to do a lot of practice in order to get back to my home. And then to realize there's only home. There's the home of this one reality, this single life, existence, whatever you call it, want to call it. There's no real name for it.
Was that the inspiration? It sounds like it's the inspiration for your book, Looking for Rain in a Monsoon.
Yeah, I mean, it was
What
an
connects with the
inspiration.
title?
Yeah, it was an inspiration for, prior to that book, I'd written two other books. Searching for Rain in a Monsoon came out
Searching for Rain,
in
yes.
2012, I think, maybe. But the first book I wrote was called Too Intimate for Words, which in the title itself, I mean, I wrote about, there was quite a lot of poetry in that first book, attempting to try to convey this basic understanding I felt that had been revealed, which was that what we're looking for is always here. That's what I wrote about in that book. But the title captures a theme that really ran through all of my earlier books, which is this, too intimate for words, this understanding that whatever this is, whatever it is that's being experienced or discovered or seen or felt or perceived, is ultimately beyond any possibility of ever describing it. And I, in that first book, Too Intimate for Words, I quote the Tao Te Ching, which says that the true Tao cannot be named. The Tao is sort of the way, the in Taoism, and it cannot be named. And in other words, it transcends language, it transcends description and conceptualization. And that turned out to be not just a theme running through my books, but the basis of what I had was kept coming to understand more and more fully, more and more deeply. That, and then really in my last book, This Extraordinary Moment, the entire book is really featuring that understanding and emphasizing that discovery that what's happening here, which we have a very rich set of words and concepts to describe and capture and characterize the life and our life as humans, that what's actually here transcends everything that we conceive of it to be. And that continues to be what my work is about, essentially, sharing with other people through my
Yeah.
writing and teaching.
If you had to classify that, this extraordinary moment, you walked into a bookstore, and would it be in the philosophy section, poetry section? Would it be in, psychology? Where would it be?
Oh, wow, that's such a good question. I don't think there's any poetry in that book, so probably not the poetry section. It could end up in a philosophy section, although I think of philosophy more as thinking about reality. I mean, there can be, like in phenomenology, there can obviously be an emphasis on experience and exploring experience of reality as part of philosophy. But I don't think of my work as philosophical, although some people see it that way. In terms of psychology and ending up in a section like that in a bookstore, I would love that to be the case because I think that the book has tremendous, what I'm pointing to just has tremendous implications for our understanding of human psychology and the things that we find challenging about our own psychologies. So, I mean, that's my own academic training and background is as a psychologist. And I teach graduate students in psychology, so I do spend quite a lot of time talking about in my teaching, at least with my grad students, how what I'm writing about the indescribable, inconceivable nature of reality, what I think that has to do with psychology and why I think it has potentially profound implications for working with people in a psychological context. So, yeah, I would hope that the book might maybe one day end up in a psychology section of a bookstore. It's more likely probably to get thrown into like a spirituality section, probably. Even though I don't think the word spiritual, I don't know, maybe the word spiritual is in the book, but it may not be. It's not a word I use very often.
Well, it certainly wouldn't be self-help section because it's not, I think that some people would probably classify that as a self-help book, but it's not about doing anything in particular to achieve wellness, is it? I mean,
Well, yeah, that's an interesting question. I mean, it could be in that section of a bookstore in this sense, which is people are searching for things. They're searching for well-being. They're searching for peace of mind. They're searching for a sense of feeling free and open and right and awake. And so I do think that, I mean, the book doesn't say, oh, there's nothing you can do to realize that because it's already here, even if it points to that in some sense. It does have many what I call guided inquiries, 40 or 50 of them in the book, they are very much designed to or invite people into an exploration of their experience to discover something about it that most humans don't recognize or are overlooking. Even if it's staring us in the face, we miss something very powerful and profound about experience, because our tendency is to orient to our descriptions of what's happening, to orient to what we think is happening, and believing that it's what we think it is. And that's all innocent. It's just a way human culture has sort of s seemed to have developed itself to orient to the descriptions primarily. And so the book is, like I say, has a number of exercises in it to reorient one to experience itself and begin to recognize the ways in which it deviates from our interpretations of it. In profound and liberating ways, it deviates from what we think it is.
And there's also another theme that runs through the book too, is a cognitive diffusion. Is what I see in these guided inquiries is witnessing life in all its fullness, but without these conceptual labels that we put on that. Can you talk a little bit more about that? Because you devoted a whole chapter to cognitive, to diffusion.
Yeah, I sometimes say that when I'm talking to people who know about that concept, say maybe people in the acceptance commitment therapy world in particular, or the mindfulness kind of world, people engaged in kind of integrating those things into psychology, let's say, that I say that the book really is, the entire book is really about diffusion. And that basic concept of fusion is one way I would characterize that, what that word is pointing to, is that there's something that's here, there's something that's present. We could call that experience. Let's call that experience. We could call it life or reality, whatever we call it. There's something here. And then there's a faculty of consciousness, a function or a dimension of consciousness that renders what's here, that essentially interprets what's here, makes sense of it somehow, puts it into various frames of reference, makes meaning out of it, and so on. And fusion is basically that we so for example, I behold what's present here, and then a part of consciousness defines it as sitting in my living room having a conversation over Zoom. Okay, so that's just without question what's going on here. I mean, that's what's happening, a way of describing this event. And fusion is basically the smearing together of that interpretation with the event. So I now think that is what's happening, is that I'm sitting in my living room having a conversation over Zoom. And it isn't that that's not accurate. In one sense, it's a perspective on what's happening here. But it turns out that what's happening here transcends that description. It's beyond that description. It's much more than that description. And the closer one investigates the events or experiences of our life, the more what can be discovered is that the descriptions that we imagine are equal to reality. That's fusion. Thinking that the interpretations are the same as reality, they're fused together. It turns out that no, actually, reality is quite distinct from the descriptions. The descriptions can't adequately convey or capture or characterize what's here. I mean, one way of understanding that is that the concepts are finite, and what's here is not finite. And so we're trying to take infinity. The conceptualizing consciousness is attempting to take what is an infinite display, you could say, of, we can't really say what it is an infinite display of ultimately, and then encapsulate that in some sort of finite frame of reference that sort of simplify it so that we can seemingly understand it. And that belief, again, that reality is equivalent to our interpretations is fusion. Diffusion is a recognition that that's not true, that what's here is not the same as what we think is here, that it's not the same. And the So really, yeah, so the entire book is about that exploration. And in that sense is fundamentally about defusing from our interpretations, our cognitions, which doesn't mean eliminating them, doesn't mean getting rid of them, negating them, which really isn't possible anyway. But it's
You think you're more fused when it's a more painful experience, painful emotional experience, or maybe a more joyous experience that you want to be fused with the experience in that sense, right? Where if you're having a good time, you don't want to, you don't want, and maybe I'm just arguing from the other point of view. If you get an award for doing something really well, you want to feel good in that moment, and that requires fusion.
I mean, yeah, you're asking an interesting question, about fusion itself. I think the pull towards fusion, because we're you could say there's as much fusion going on with so-called positive states as there is with so-called negative states, in a sense. And I think that the pull to fusion, why we orient to the descriptive frameworks as being truth, essentially, is that we could say as organisms, we seem to be drawn to things like certainty and security, a sense of like knowing what's going on. Because if we don't really have knowledge about what's going on, then things could feel very ambiguous, uncertain, up in the air, right? Unclear as to what's happening here. So there's a strong impetus, it would seem, as organisms to resolve this somehow, to explain this, to put this into a framework of explanation, right? And so there's a very strong motivation for that to be for our explanations to be true. Because if someone starts poking holes in our frames of reference and our certainty about them, that can feel very destabilizing at some level, I think, to the organism, because it's like, wait a minute, where's my compass? Where's my, right? How do I orient to this without my maps? If the maps are essentially incomplete, which they are, because every map of the territory is an oversimplification of the territory. That's sort of its utility, is that it takes all this complexity and makes it simpler and more manageable, right? That's a value of just a regular old physical map. We hardly use those anymore, right? We have the maps on our phones, but it's the same thing, right? It's like taking all this complexity that is the city of Paris, and then creating a map of that, which is a dumbed down, simplified, overgeneralized reduction of that complexity into something manageable that I can then use to navigate around the city, right? Orient to the city. And but the same with our cognitive maps, our schemas, as the psychologists call them, which are, my way of navigating reality, we could say, right? So, if you start inviting people to explore the ways in which what's here transcends the maps, the territory of experience can't actually be fully encapsulated in the maps that we've created, consciousness has created, that can be initially, maybe at first glance, a bit overwhelming to consider, a bit challenging to let that in, because it's like, well, where's my compass again? Where's my knowledge about what things are? Because I'm really suggesting that we don't know what's here. We can't actually come to a conclusion about what's here.
You are suggesting that what we see, just kind of like Donald Hoffman, what we see, what we witness is 180 degrees different
Yes.
than really what is.
Correct. And in relationship to, we can circle back for a moment to, that initial sort of discovery that was made on that retreat that I was sharing with you. about that what I'd been looking for was already here. It was what I was. Another way to understand that would be that what was initially being perceived as almost like the default kind of human vantage is that I'm an individual, a separate individual existing in a world. I'm an autonomous creature living in an objective world. And that's consensus reality. And so then, from within that frame of reference, excuse me, I, the individual, have an idea in mind of realizing some transcendental reality, call it God, call it spirit, call it existence. And I'm going to claw my way back to recognizing that. And as an individual, I'm going to somehow do that. And that's, of course, a way of conceptualizing it. But what was discovered, in a nascent form on that retreat, and then subsequently continued to sort of unpack itself over a period of years, that separation is an abstraction. It's a way of conceiving of what's here, that I'm a separate individual living in a world. But experience itself, what you're feeling right now, what's being felt and experienced right now, in that, there is no separation, actually, from what I call the experiential perspective. Sure, I can conceive of a world of separate objects and pieces and parts that are in interaction with one another. But experientially, from the experiential perspective, there's no separation. There's just experience, literally. So that is a startling thing to discover that perspective, that what I would call that transcendental perspective. It transcends boundaries and borders and reveals another vantage on life, which I would call the undivided perspective. And you can feel that right now. I mean, you can, if you feel experience, you can, I mean, a very simple place to simple way to into that is to feel the sense of being alive, which is very primal sort of encounter that we have, the sense of aliveness. And then ordinarily we think that this life is circumscribed in some way. There's a boundary around this life, and then what's beyond the boundary of this life is not me, right? It's the world outside of this bounded me. Usually the skin is the sense of the boundary of my life. But even that is a concept. I'm not saying it's untrue from within its own frame of reference, but experientially, if you feel what you call the body, you could do that. People listening can do that right now. If you feel what you call the body, the skin suit that apparently separates us from the world, what do you actually find there experientially? You don't find a body. A body is a concept. You find experience. You could call it sensation, but that's also another label. So let's just stay with experience itself and recognizing that the experience doesn't have any labels intrinsic to it. There's not an experience with a label and a name tag that says body. There's just experience. Can't really say what it is, but feeling what's present as experience that we might describe as the body. And you can notice something quite extraordinary, which is that this thing we're calling the body, which we're experiencing, this experience, has no edge to it. It has no edge to it. It has no, there's no f place where the experience comes to an end. You can feel that. You don't hit some wall where you stop. There's no wall here. There's no boundary here in experience. So this exploration can begin to highlight the way in which what we think of as boundaries and borders and walls between one thing and another are conceived. But experientially, again, there's no boundary here. So this sense of my life that I often imagine as being bounded, circumscribed, doesn't have an end to it. It doesn't have a border to it. So all I find in this exploration of my experience, you could say, is this sense of life. Everywhere I go in this field of experience, I encounter this sense of aliveness, this sense of presence of life. And I can give it different names, thoughts, feelings, sensations, and even a world, but all of that is being encountered as experience, as a sense of this alive presence. And this alive presence does not have any firm borders or boundaries anywhere to be found. This is what I mean by the undivided experiential perspective, which, as he said, is 180 degrees distinct from my ordinary way of conceiving the world, which is I'm a subject in an objective world. I can feel that perspective, that I'm separate, I'm an individual separate from you as another individual. I can sense that as one way of encountering reality. And then I can feel that there's just a flow of experiencing here, where there's no boundary at all. There's just a flow of experiencing. It's completely boundless and borderless. And so there's not some individual separate from the world, separate from life, separate from existence. There's just life. Just, as if it's somehow less than. There is life. There is the magnificence of life. Magnificence of this mysterious, miraculous existence. And nothing else. And everything from this vantage can be felt and recognized to be nothing but an expression of that one singular life, that one vitality, that one presence. And that's a very, very, very different way to experience the moments of our lives.
Would you consider yourself a non-dualist, or is that the right descriptor for what you're describing?
I mean, people could categorize what I'm talking about, put it into that category. Yeah, I mean, I don't have a quarrel with that in terms of a way of conceptualizing it or talking about it. Non-dual in the sense of cutting through the notion of there being a multiplicity of things. I mean, it's very paradoxical because this one thing, call it life, call it existence, call it reality, shows up as this just incredible, astonishing multiplicity of different forms and flavors and textures and qualities. I mean, there's nothing but distinction. This is the ultimate paradox, right? There's nothing but difference. And yet all of it shares in common this one thing, this one. Everything is of this one. Well, there's really no way to say what everything is made of. That's a central to your earlier question about diffusion. A central thing that I'm exploring in my work and sharing with others is comes through asking a very simple yet profound question, which is what is experience itself? Because I have all these experiences and I'm basically asking people, what is the substance of experience? What is all of this made of? What is your experience made of? I mean, I have a lot of words to describe the myriad experiences I can have as a human: happiness, sadness, joy, sorrow, confusion, clarity, bliss, despair, right, hopelessness, courage. I mean, all these ways of characterizing the multiplicity of experiential qualities and flavors. But regardless of how I'm describing it with language and concepts, what is it? What is it fundamentally constituted of? In much the same way that a material scientist would explore what is the physical universe made of, right? We can ask the same question about what is this moment made of, this moment that we're experiencing right now. I could call, like I was saying earlier, I could say, well, one way I could describe this is I'm sitting here, sitting in a chair. So I'm describing this moment, right, with those words, sitting in a chair. What is sitting in a chair made of? What is that experience made of? I've got this label to describe it, but what is it actually? Well, that it turns out that that's a question that doesn't really have an answer, which is the answer. You can't really say what this moment is made of, and but that can be, it's not enough in my mind to just believe that as some idea that you can't know what your experience is made of, but to explore your experience and discover that you can't get to the bottom of it. You can't come to a final conclusion about, what is the essence of my experience? What is it made of? What's it fundamentally constituted of? You keep looking and you just find more and more and more and more. You never get to the bottom because it's infinite. And that's one reason I say that it's not describable ultimately. So if it's not describable, then what about all these descriptive maps that I'm using?
Right.
That's what diffusion is, discovering that it's not describable.
Okay. All right.
And that puts all the maps into a very different sort of context. That, okay, the maps may be useful to orient us in certain ways under certain circumstances, but they're not actually telling us the whole truth of what's here, because what's here is transcends the maps.
Well, it brings up an interesting question, because this is not just a motivation out of curiosity, although it's part of that, of what is experience, what is sitting. But it's I want to read you a quote that Deepak Chopra wrote about your book. He said, "The realization that there is no explanation for existence or awareness of existence is ultimate liberation." Can you expand on that and describe what he meant by liberation?
I can definitely explain what I would mean by that. I don't know about Deepak, but I mean, I think what is it that makes us feel bound? What is it ma that makes us feel stuck, right? We could think of the antithesis of liberation, right? What is it that makes me feel like I am somehow constricted or bound or caught in something, stuck in something, imprisoned by something, i.e., not free, right? Not liberated. Well, it's our descriptions of things, ultimately. It's how we're construing them, how we're thinking of them, how we're imagining them to be based on our mental frames of reference, conceptual frames of reference. And as I say in the book, the notion that I'm an individual, first of all, is a concept. That I'm a human being is a concept. That I exist encased in this body skin suit is a concept. And then, as this individual, this skin-bound creature, navigating this objective world, what am I encountering? Well, I'm trying to find well-being in this world. I'm trying to secure well-being. Humans seem to be doing that, right? Searching for it, trying to have as many positive experiences as possible, as many positive relationships as possible, as much enjoyable work as they can, try to avoid painful experiences, try to keep ourselves from being overwhelmed by the vicissitudes of life and the challenges of life and the stress of life and the losses that are seem inherent to life. So trying to increase well-being and minimize, right, suffering and pain and so on. It's all very natural. And but oftentimes we can feel as these individuals we imagine or conceive of ourselves to be in this objective world that we can feel at times overwhelmed by this world of experience and circumstance, right? Threatened by it, caught in it, stuck in it, victimized by it. And that is a perspective, and it's the one we basically know as humans, most humans, right? And so then we can explore, as I did in that little brief kind of inquiry that I did, wow, there's this other perspective. There's this other perspective that I'm not living, I'm not an individual merely, I'm not merely an individual living in an objective world and separate from that world in some sense, as and potentially overwhelmed by that world, right? I am this world. In other words, there's just, it's indivisible, it's inseparable. There's just the world or just reality or just life. And so in that sense, from that perspective, I'm not a potential victim of life. That could be harmed by life. I am life. There's no separation. Feel how radically distinct that is as a perspective. I'm an expression of life, not a victim of it, from that vantage. And that is, I'm liberated. I'm liberated from whatever I imagine could be missing. I'm liberated from whatever I imagine could be harmful. I'm liberated from imagining things that could overwhelm or destroy or crush or limit or right or deny me. I'm liberated from that because I've now recognized this other perspective, which is there's not an individual living in the world. There's just this flow of inseparability, which can't really be described or characterized with any words, which is why the Tao Te Ching, as I said that the Tao, the true Tao, cannot be named, because any word would be making what is infinite and indescribable seemingly finite and describable, which it's not.
And I can see the paradox arising in a lot of people's heads, and it certainly arose in mine for quite some time, that you're describing something, and it relates back how we use language and how we inherently are geared toward using language as literal descriptors. So when you mention, well, here's how you diffuse. Here's what diffusion means, and then the implication of that is, well, you should diffuse as if I need to do something. But on the other hand, you're describing, well, no, you don't really have to do anything. You have to be, and so it's how we use language that's awfully time oftentimes very confusing. We use language in a very functional sense, but not in a literal sense, if you know what I mean. And so can you expand on that a bit more?
Well, I think we do end up often taking it in a literal sense. I mean, that's right. I mean, that's that's partly what, and there's this whole term of deliteralizing, which is kind of recognizing that however functional the language may be as a way of orienting, we take it literally, you know, like it could be functional to talk about myself as being distinct from the world, but to take it literally is to imagine that I actually am separate from the world. But investigation can reveal that that doesn't hold up under scrutiny, right? So being able to seemingly name things can be functional as a way of communicating about those things, for example. Like I can tell you, you know, well, how are you doing today, John? I say, well, I'm feeling a little anxious today because I have this big presentation. And you're like, oh, really? Well, tell me about that anxiety. And I can talk about that anxiety. Okay, that has some functional utility, arguably. But to my earlier discussion comment about what is experience, let's take that. What is anxiety? And this is something many people struggle with, and increasingly large numbers of particularly young people, alarmingly high percentage of the population is struggling with anxiety. What is anxiety? Well, when you explore it as an, it's a label that's describing something, right? As they say in linguistics, it's a signifier, signifying something. It's referring to something, representing something, semantically. What is it representing? What's actually there? Well, you could say it's a sort of a particular constellation of thoughts and feelings and sensations that make up this sort of gestalt that you call anxiety. But that really begs a question. Well, what are thoughts, feelings, and sensations? Right? What are they? I mean, I really, really mean that. What is a thought? You investigate anything that you have a label for in this way that I'm talking about, and you come up empty-handed. You cannot say what anything is. You cannot determine. It's indeterminate what experiential phenomena are constituted of. It doesn't resolve. It's the great paradox that the closer you investigate experience, the less resolution you have, the less clarity you have about what it is. And because it just opens and reveals there's just more and more and more detail, seemingly more and more experiential. It's like the particles of experience, I call it, like you would have the particles of matter, the subatomic particles, the particles of experience. What is experience? It's like these kind of crackling, sizzling, buzzing, fizzing kind of, you call it energy or vibrations. I mean, really, what is experience? This is an amazing question. And so again, to the comment that Deepak made about, that this exploration is ultimately liberating. So if I'm experiencing something like anxiety and I'm bothered by it and I feel like I'm overwhelmed by it and it's concerning to me, it feels threatening to me, it's like when I explore what it is in the ways that I'm describing, and I discover that it's some inconceivable dance of, I'm throwing words at something for which there are no words, because you can't really say what it is. But discovering that you cannot conclude what anxiety is, that it's unknowable, it's inconceivable, it's infinite, ungraspable. In a sense, in a very real sense, you discover that you're liberated from the implications suggested by language and conceptualization. In other words, there's not a thing there to be stuck in. There's not a thing there to be stuck in, or trapped in, or limited by. There aren't things. Even though the world looks like things, it looks like phenomena with continuity and seeming resolvability and definability. It looks like that, and we can talk about the world in that way, and we do, right? But again, when we investigate it, we discover that's not the whole story. The world can also be experienced as wholly not a thing that's resolvable, but just this bottomless, infinite, yet incredibly alive, potent, vibrant, awake presence. And that is what I would say discovering the problem-free nature of experience. That what we imagined based on our conceptualizations to be problematic from this other vantage are seen to be transcend problem, because a problem is a definition, it's a description to say it's a problem. When you go to look for it again and you come up empty-handed because it's of its unresolvable nature, indefinable nature, there's not someone trapped in something else. There's just this wide open, open-ended indescribability. That's not nothing. It's very full, very alive. It's just that you can't really pin down what it is ultimately. And yet it's full and rich beyond measure.
Yeah, when you talk to your graduate students and graduate students that are you teach therapists, right? Or you
I
or
teach,
speech
yeah, I teach
therapists.
therapists in training, so clinical counseling psychology students, getting their master's degrees.
Is a common question that you ask that you're asked is, well, how do I apply this? I mean, these are great. It's a great new perspective. How in the world do I apply this to my training?
Well, I take
Exercises that I can do in order to be better myself and tell my clients or what?
I mean, absolutely, people are curious. The majority of them are quite curious and intrigued by this perspective. And then, often are quick. I mean, they're training to be therapists, so they're looking for tools that they can use with their clients, of course. And I talk very much in those classes about defusion because it's a term that psychologists are increasingly talking about, through the influence of things like ACT. And so I put in that frame of reference is helpful, I think. But I often find that they're many times kind of jumping the gun a little bit because they want to apply it to their client, their future clients. Of course, I want to bring these tools to my clients, but I say, well, the best way to do that is to get very familiar with the tools yourself. You have to do this, you have to do the math yourself to really be able to share it with another person, I think, effectively. And I mean, certainly I say to them that my own sharing of it with others, my teaching and writing and all of this, I mean, no one taught me how to introduce another person to this. It just came straight out of my own exploration of it. And so then that, I say to them, it becomes more and more natural to figure out how to convey these ideas and these insights and these discoveries about the nature of experience to others, let's say your clients, by discovering it in your own experience. And then you're that much more compelled to want to share it because you've discovered, you've tasted for yourself the liberating nature of this perspective. That essentially frees us from the seeming implications of our language and concepts. And, it's curious to me. I mean, in some ways, this is a largely unknown sort of notion within the field of psychology, I would say. I mean, the term cognitive diffusion is not unknown. I mean, increasingly more known, I would say. I'm not so sure that the people that talk about cognitive fusion and diffusion within psychology, though, are really taking it to the same degree, maybe that I seem to be taking it, in which I'm really calling into question everything we conceive about reality. Without, again, discounting the value of the concepts. I would never suggest that. There's nothing wrong with concepts. It's just that they're not telling us the whole story about what's going on here. And that's the key. That's the key to defusion. Just to see that this is much more than our conceptualizations of it. I should add one thing and I really do emphasize this because I think it's a very non-abstract way into this discovery of how reality or experience transcends our descriptions and definitions. And that is to to notice in a very simple way that your experience right now is just not holding still. Your experience is dynamic, isn't it? It would seem. That the perception that's here right now is here for how long exactly? It's here in a very real sense for no time at all. Because it's not as if there's a perception of the moment that arises, perceptual arising. Here's the perception of this moment, and it's not like the perception occurs and then it freezes. And it's like a freeze frame, right? I can stop the film. There it is. There's my perception. There's what the moment looks like. Now I can define it. I can capture it in my concepts. It's not like that. Our language suggests that it's like that, right? It suggests that things have fixity, that they have endurance, that they endure. Hence, I can now name them because there's something there with endurance, with continuity that I can describe. But investigating experience reveals that that falls apart, that this is whatever I've defined as a momentary perception, a momentary experience. Ah, there it is. Fear, joy, anxiety, worry, confusion. Just describe, like a pattern arises, and I describe the pattern, right? Recognize the pattern. Oh, that's familiar to me. I know what that's fear, that's anxiety. Okay, so I recognize this pattern, but again, the pattern's not static. Pattern doesn't pattern itself. Life doesn't pattern itself as a particular experience and then just stay there. It's moving. I say, it's not like things take shape and then they just hang out in that shape. It's like a better way to describe it is that the moment is shaping. It's shaping. It's not taking shape. It
Yeah.
keeps moving. It keeps opening. It keeps transforming.
Yeah.
Doesn't transform and then stop its transformation, seemingly. It's in a constant state of transformation. And because it's in a constant state of, seems to be, in a constant state of transformation, I actually can't define it.
Right.
Because the minute I've defined this transformational movement that I call life, that I call my experience, it just moved on to a new version of that, which I seemingly described, right? So, in a sense, all my definitions are not of what is here right now. They are definitions of what was here an instant ago or a few moments ago. Because what's here now is different. Even if in subtle ways, it's not the same.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that simple discovery can open the door in a very powerful way to reveal that this that's here, the moment, transcends whatever we've defined it to be. Because the definition, again, what's here is no longer here. In the very instant that I speak it, it's no longer here.
Yeah, it's almost like the in language a more accurate description of what's going on is just using verbs, right?
Yeah.
We could only if we could cut out the nouns, the subjects, the predicates, and just use verbs to describe exactly what's going on, that's a constant
It would be more
change.
accurate, yes. I think
Yeah,
there's a
exactly.
chapter in my last book, The World Is Not Made of Nouns.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
Exactly.
yeah.
But if you think about how people are relating and making sense of their experience through language and conceptualization, we're tending to conceive of the world as fixed phenomena, as right, as things.
Yeah.
Even the states of mind, which we know to be dynamic and changing, I mean fluid, right? They're fluid. Our moods are fluid. We
Right.
still think of them as fixed objects, like fixed material objects. So we call them at we describe them as nouns.
Yeah.
And you know, it's again, you know, you talk about the functional utility of language. It's like I'm talking about a world that's a non-languaged, a wordless world. In the world of experience, there's just no language that will suffice. Period.
Yeah.
It's beyond words. The world of language, again, it's a beautiful world. The world of descriptions, we can communicate, we're using language in our whole conversation. But it's extraordinary to realize that there's another world, this or another, you know, I've been referring to this a lot lately because it's such a nice metaphor for this, the differing perspectives I'm talking about, of these, you know, kind of visual illusions, you know, where you can see it two different ways, like the young woman and the old woman, you know, that black and white image. So which one is it? Which perspective is the true perspective? Well, you can see it either way, right? It's one
Yeah,
image
nice.
that can be seen in two different ways. And I would say the same here, that there's one singularity, one reality that can be perceived as divided and separate and definable and describable. And you can just flip your perspective once you get more familiar with this other perspective and just realize instantly that, wow, there's this other way of encountering it, which is just so freeing. Because you're freed, you can feel the freedom from all the descriptors and languaging, which tends to limit and oversimplify what's here. It tends to diminish what's here. What's here is, and this happens a lot with our way we're languaging things. It's like, well, here I am in my same old life, you know, doing my thing I do every day, and right, my mundane existence, and, that's all descriptions of something that's. I titled the book This Extraordinary Moment. it points to like that this is not, it could look very ordinary, like you're just everyday normalcy, but what is it actually? It's just this astonishing miracle of aliveness. What you might think of as I'm just doing my day. It's like, really? What's here? What's actually here that we might be describing and dumbing down as this is my boring life, you know? It's like, really? Take another look. Everything is shockingly alive and vibrant and scintillating in its aliveness. Everything. When we look at it outside of the normal frames of reference that we're bringing to it, where we're often dismissing and discounting a lot of the data showing up in the field of experience as inconsequential, right? Well, who cares about that? The way the light is flickering there. Who cares about that little shape on the sidewalk? That's insignificant. It doesn't mean anything. But that's a description, isn't it? That it doesn't mean anything.
Yeah.
What I would suggest, and this has to be discovered ultimately, my suggesting it is like putting out a hypothesis for people to experiment with, but when you just look at what's here, when you just feel what's here, you can discover that people are very interested in finding meaning and purpose in a sense in life, understandable. But there's a meaningfulness that I would say is intrinsic to reality itself that has nothing to do with our mental notions of meaning, our conceptual notions of what this means. It's inherently meaningful. It's inherently profound. Not because I'm thinking it to be so, but because it is. In the direct encounter, it's very hard to describe this again because it's beyond words, but it's almost like I could look at something in my visual field that doesn't seem very consequential, like there's a little throw rug at the foot of my couch over here, and it's pretty, I could say it's pretty bland and not that, you know, I wouldn't necessarily say it's a beautiful thing per se, you know, it's not that interesting. It's kind of a industrial carpet and or a little throw, a little small little piece of carpet. And but that's all, again, that's all, those are all ideas about what it is, right? Now let me just look at it. Let me just perceive whatever I'm perceiving. Because all those labels, like it's not beautiful, it's just inconsequential, those are all overlays, mental overlays. So those can be there, but what is actually there? What's actually present? And when I look in that way, just at what's present, that doesn't have a label intrinsic to it, somehow what seems to be revealed whenever I do that is the inherent richness of it, the inherent beauty of it, the inherent meaningfulness of it, simply because it is. Simply because it exists. I mean, if you even think about it in terms of like physics, and you say, well, that, like every other phenomena that exists in reality and that's perceived, is made of, you know, atoms and subatomic particles and is being essentially moved by the laws of the laws of nature, right? I mean, the physical laws of nature. That's what that is. So I'm looking at the laws of nature there. I'm looking at the most profound thing that exists. I'm looking at the miracle of life itself, right? In that silly, stupid little piece of carpet. I'm literally looking at the nature of reality. Not as a philosophy, to your early question about what section does my book belong in. That's like, could sound very philosophical. I'm looking at the nature of reality. It's actually literally true. I'm looking at the nature of reality. What else could I be looking at? So yeah, from one perspective, I'm looking at a stupid piece of carpet, but I'm looking at life itself in that particular form. And if I look at you, it's the same thing. I'm looking at life itself in this particular form that I call you. So this is another way to perceive the world, to basically see the profound meaningfulness of everything, the profound significance of everything, because everything is made of the same thing, which is can't be said what that is. But it is made of it, clearly, because here it is. And very different way to perceive the world, needless to say. One way I describe this is it's cutting through the hierarchy of this is better than that, this is more meaningful than that, this is more significant than that, this is more beautiful than that. That is one way to perceive the world. It's one we're familiar with, of course, but this is another way where you're cutting to the core. You're coming to discover the common denominator of everything, as I say, that equalizes everything. But it equalizes everything not in a diminishing way, but you're discovering that the common denominator of everything is this profoundness, the mystery of life, right? What could be more profound than the mystery of life itself? And everything is the mystery of life itself, right? What else is it?
Beautiful. What who I just want to leave off on this question. Authors, who are your more profound authors? Who have you read that would you say really transformed you?
Well, I've been influenced by many different, I mean, teachers and teachings over the years. I don't read a lot. I don't study very many teachers and teachings. I'm sort of seem to be pretty preoccupied with my own explorations directly of my own experience ongoingly, and then essentially reporting from the front lines about my own experience, one way I think about my writing and teaching. And so I'm less interested in having any sort of intermediary there, telling me about my experience. Experience is, I say, is the ultimate teacher, the ultimate guru. That said, I mean, again, I have been benefited enormously by different teachers that I've studied with over the years. Over the last probably now 6 or so years, I was working with a client, and I write about this in the intro to my book. I was working with this client talking about things as you and I are speaking about, and he sort of stopped me and he said, the way you speak about life, about reality, sounds a lot like my teacher, a teacher of mine. I said, well, who is that? And he said, his name's Peter Brown. And I said, I don't know who Peter Brown is. I never heard of him. And I got very curious, so I went and checked out Peter Brown. And yes, he's a largely unknown teacher. He may be at the end of his life, actually. He's in his late 60s now, but he is an extraordinary teacher, and he teaches a what he calls a yoga of radiant presence, and he speaks very, I mean, there's a reason why my client said that what I was sharing reminded him of Peter, because when I met his teaching, I felt like I was listening to myself, but just in a way that was just so clear and so refined and profound that I've continued to really enjoy his work as much as any teaching that I've come across.
Yeah, you mentioned him in this extraordinary moment. Thank you so much, John. This has been a real pleasure for me.
Well, the pleasure was mine too. It was great to chat with you.
Thank you. And I wish you well. And any new books coming up anytime soon? Any new projects?
I put out a free ebook during COVID, called Everything Is a Doorway. You can find it on my website, johnaston.com. And I don't have plans for writing another book just yet. I mean, I'm still writing just when it happens spontaneously. I don't necessarily have a book idea in mind, but we'll see what happens.
Well, you also have your YouTube channel.
I have I post I host a weekly Zoom meeting on Sundays, Sunday morning,
Oh, cool.
10 a.m. West Coast time. that's open to anyone, where I explore all of this. And usually at the beginning of those meetings, I lead a little guided sort of inquiry, and I've been recording those and posting those on YouTube, and you can find those on my website as well. It can take you to my YouTube channel. There's about 75 or so of those videos up on YouTube now. And yeah, you're welcome to, folks are welcome to check that out as well if they're interested in some of the stuff we've been exploring today. Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Thanks to you.
And yeah, I appreciate your time.
Yeah.
And I wish you well.
Thanks. Right back at you.
Okay.
Spit on the ground, hold your breath, try to scare yourself to death. Bury your bones under the dirt and tear at your heart and rip your shirt and stomp your feet in disgust. Curse the gray skies if you must, but you'll find when you are done, blue skies for everyone. Your heart and give up the race before you start. Drop your drawers and roll around. Burn your house right to the ground. Go to sleep, hit your head, scream until your face is red. But you'll find when you are done, blue skies for everyone. Blue skies, setting sun, and cherry pie.